This is Richard E. Rao. I am including for the National Council of Jewish Women the Industrial Archives Collection for the University of Pittsburgh Hillman Library, a chapter in a book that is being compiled. It is called The Golden Age of Pittsburgh Theater, a Molloy Compilation. This is a book which includes theaters in the Pittsburgh area, written by those who were who ran them or affiliated with them for the last 40 years. I am including a chapter on the Pittsburgh Playhouse as part of my contribution. This paper that I wrote was written between January and April of 1998. I am recording it on June the 17th, 1998. And I will begin reading this paper now. Pittsburgh Playhouse, A Failed Dream, 1934 to 1974, A Personal History by Richard E. Rao. And that is me. I am the person who wrote this, and I am also recording this. Some references in my text are from S. Joseph Nassif's 1973 dissertation, A History of the Pittsburgh Playhouse School of the Theater, 1934 to 1969. Those references will be indicated as SJN. It almost feels as if I had two births in my life. My actual one occurred on April 23, 1940, at St. Margaret's Hospital in Pittsburgh. My mother told me she wanted me to be born on Shakespeare's birthday. But the second birth happened at the age of 6 months, when my parents proudly wheeled me in my stroller into the lobby of a theater at Kraft Avenue and Hamlet Street called the Pittsburgh Playhouse. That's how it began for me. I've often imagined my parents wanting to give me a symbolic jump start on a dazzling career in the theater as I lay in my stroller taking in the atmosphere of that lobby in October of 1940. But whatever their motives, the fact was that theater has been in my blood from the beginning. And when my mother took me to the first children's show at the Old Schenley Theater and to Henry Betcher's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream at Carnegie Tech in 1948, I was hooked for life. In fact, since 1966, I have been acting in Pittsburgh theaters, including 12 productions from 1970 to 1998 at the Pittsburgh Playhouse. Also, for 9 years, I have taught theater history, and recently I have been writing drama reviews for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. My family connection with the Playhouse began in 1934, when my father, Richard S. Rao, who was vice president of Bankers Lithographing Company, brought together some prominent Pittsburgh citizens and founded the Pittsburgh Playhouse. And my mother, Helen Wayne Rao, fresh from the class of 1933 at Carnegie Tech, became a distinguished actress at the Playhouse for the next 39 years, appearing in 38 productions. For the last 20 years, at least, I have heard the same romantic fantasy about my parents, that my father started the Playhouse as a place for my mother to act. There may be some truth to it, but I don't think it was that simple. Rather, it was a perfect combination of my father's passion for a new theater in 1934 and my parents' marriage in 1935. My father had high hopes for his young bride, who one Pittsburgh paper had said was a sure bet for Broadway. He suggested that they move to New York, but my mother never left Pittsburgh, and the Playhouse became a kind of second home, a perfect venue for her acting talents. In the first two seasons, in fact, she appeared in 10 plays, but from 1937 to 1941 in only one show, and from 1942 to 1973 in an additional 28 productions. It wasn't the quantity, but the quality of her performances that many remember. In the first play I saw her do, Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, in 1949, the critics loved her. I don't remember much about that play, but I did ask my father to take me up on the set and show me where the steps led. When I discovered that they went to the backstage area, I had my first crushing dose of reality, but it didn't diminish my growing interest. For the next 28 years, I eagerly anticipated seeing my mother's hilarious performances, her timing all was perfect, her line delivery guaranteeing instant laughs. But in 1959, there was one exception. Milton Kiselas directed her in Paddy Chayefsky's searing drama, Middle of the Night, a complete departure from her comedic roles. She received strong reviews, but I never saw the show. A week before it opened, we had a doozy of a fight, and she told me positively not to come. I didn't, and I've always regretted it. Later, she appeared in many hits, but she reached her peak in the 1960s with three commercial and artistic successes that highlighted her comedic skills. Come Blow Your Horn, Bye Bye Birdie, and Arthur Kopit's Oh Dad, Poor Dad, Mama's Hung You in the Closet, and I'm Feeling So Sad. No matter how my parents imagined the Playhouse, it was certainly started by many people who had similar hopes and dreams and a love of the theater. My father felt that the new theater in Oakland would become a magnet for the disparate theater groups who would use the new facility as a showcase and training ground for actors and technicians from all over the Pittsburgh area. As my mother said in a 1971 interview, my father's dream was to, quote, have a nationally recognized community theater in Pittsburgh, unquote, SJN, page 15. But ultimately, the goal was to have a semi-professional space using local talent, SJN, page 18. Certainly, decades later, those aims had been met. My father assembled a formidable group of community leaders, including Mrs. J. Frank Drake, the Playhouse's first president, Charles J. Rosenblum, Mrs. Howard Hines, A. W. Schmidt, Mrs. Albert S. F. Keister, Dr. Harvey Gall, Ferd Weil, and Mrs. David Craig, to name only a few. In addition, there was an advisory board that included Carnegie Tech faculty members Ben Iden Payne, Frank Stout, and Chester Wallace. And newspaper critics were represented, including George Seibel, Casper Monahan, and the Post-Gazette's remarkable Harold V. Cohen, one of Pittsburgh's great theater critics. In the early years, the Playhouse attracted eager actors, playwrights, directors, and technicians. Subscriptions grew, and after the first season, where plays had been done in the Frick School in Oakland, the board found a new home, a former German social club at Kraft and Hamlet Streets in Oakland. So in 1934, the Playhouse was launched. In its first season, my mother and Robert Gill appeared in its first production on December 10, 1934, Art and Mrs. Bottle, by Ben Levy and directed by Helen Stout. By the second season, the Playhouse had found its new home. On December 3, 1935, the Playhouse opened its new season with The Wind and the Rain, my mother was in that one too, in the Hamlet Street Theater. It was directed by Herbert V. Gallendre, a former Broadway director who had been brought in to be the new artistic director of the Playhouse. Gallendre lasted two seasons. He attempted to create a professional company, bringing in four New York actors and using local actors, training them to be equity professionals. SJN, page 41. But in an ironic foreshadowing of similar problems in the 1960s, Gallendre alienated the board for two reasons. His productions became increasingly avant-garde and inaccessible to the public, and the, quote, professional, unquote, tinge seemed to undercut the Playhouse's original mission. Gallendre was replaced by Fred Burley, a Yale graduate and head of the Civic Theater in Indianapolis, SJN, page 57. Burley became the dominant force at the Playhouse from 1937 until his resignation in 1965. Whatever anyone may say about Fred Burley, and there is plenty of room for criticism, the fact is that his 28-year tenure as artistic director was a remarkable one. What Burley pledged to do was to give the Playhouse back to the people of Pittsburgh, to give actors a place for their talents. Years after Burley had left, he maintained his philosophy about community theater. Quote, people like to see people from their own city rather than outsiders. With Carnegie Tech and other institutions, Pittsburgh produced a high standard of professional amateurs, that is, professionally trained, non-equity performers. Unquote. SJN, page 59. Even critic Harold V. Cohen reported on the big change at the Playhouse. He was pleased that Burley was now using only local actors. Quote, it's a pleasure to report this morning that the new deal at the Pittsburgh Playhouse is off on the right foot under the able direction of Mr. Frederick Burley, apparently a gentleman who is willing to pass up art if he can for entertainment, unquote. SJN, page 61. That was the crux of Burleigh's formula for the Playhouse. Each season there would be a liberal dose of light comedies and an occasional musical revue or mystery interspersed with one or two heavy dramas. But Burleigh's words would haunt him in the tumultuous era of the 1960s. I really never knew Burleigh, but some actors I have talked with over the years thought he was a cold fish, imperious and uncaring. They had a certain fondness and even respect for him, though there were some grumbling. There was some grumbling people. Even my mother had her difficulties with him. During my high school and college days, I remember her complaining that Burleigh had overlooked her for key roles and hadn't cast her enough. She was particularly upset over his not wanting to give her the lead in Thornton Wilder's The Matchmaker in 1958. She apparently badgered him so much, he finally gave in to her. The critics loved her in that show, and I remember her pleasure at being vindicated. Whatever Burleigh's real and imagined shortcomings were, he helped to make the Playhouse a theatrical force in Western Pennsylvania. In fact, in some ways, a Pittsburgh institution. Even in the 90s, the name carries a certain cachet. And Fred Burleigh's name will always be associated, for better or worse, with Pittsburgh's golden age of community theater. By the beginning of the 60s, Burleigh was being accused of losing touch with the theater scene. His directorial efforts seemed to be tired and unimaginative, though he directed one of the Playhouse's biggest hits, Come Blow Your Horn, in 1963. But in his glory days, it was quite different. For instance, in his first season, he directed Charles Gaynor's revue Hold Your Hats in 1938 with 26-year-old Gene Kelly. By his second season, he tackled Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, Emlyn Williams's taut thriller Night Must Fall, Noel Coward's Fluff Tonight at 8:30, and two Molière farces, The Hypochondriac and The Doctor in Spite of Himself. By 1940, in Burleigh's third season, he staged Wilder's Our Town with himself as stage manager, S.N. Bierman's sophisticated biography, and Coward's delightful Private Lives. Even in the 1947-50 seasons, Burleigh directed some of the theater's best works, including Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Paycock, Shakespeare's Macbeth, George S. Kaufman's and Ring Lardner's June Moon, Arthur Miller's All My Sons, Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, Eugene O'Neill's Anna Christie, George Bernard Shaw's Captain Brassbound's Conversion, and Lillian Hellman's Another Part of the Forest. When the Playhouse opened its third season in 1936 in the 260-seat Hamlet Street Theater, increased to 337 seats in the 1939 season, SJN, page 72, a basic subscription cost $7 for six plays, and a dinner in the new Playhouse Grill cost $1. SJN, page 41. Especially in the 1930s and 1940s, the Playhouse became the place to be. Its theater operation thrived, attendance and subscriptions grew yearly, and the critics were often pleased with what they saw. World War II slowed Playhouse growth, but after the war, the Playhouse experienced spectacular successes with Burleigh in complete charge of its artistic direction and a proactive board that kept costs down and profits up. From 1947 to 1950, my father led the Playhouse through some of its most successful years. It was during this exciting post-war time in the late 1940s that I began to make the Playhouse my second home. I remember my parents taking me on Sundays to the Playhouse restaurant, where the Devonshire sandwich was invented. The restaurant was magnificently run by Frank Blandy. It had the best food in the city, and you always felt like this was the only place to be. After a Steeler football game or a Pirate game, players would mix it up with Playhouse patrons in the Social Register of Pittsburgh. It was a fabulous melting pot. When I had dinner, my parents made sure I always got my Shirley Temple cocktail, and for the only time in my life, I even ate frog's legs, which were always featured on the menu. But my father, whose dreams helped nurture the Playhouse, had an even larger vision. He embarked while president on a $1,250,000 drive to give it a new home on land used by a Minute car wash. The new home, where the present Howard Johnson's Marriott Motel stands, was at a major intersection on the Boulevard of the Allies. He enlisted support from all kinds of theater luminaries, including Thornton Wilder, New York Times critic Brooks Atkinson, and actors Judith Anderson and Maurice Evans. Architect Charles Stotts was picked to design the building, and famous New York set designer Joe Melziner was to design the theater space. The space became a wonderful 750-seat amphitheater with a thrust stage that also concealed a four-stage extension that could be electrically raised for acting space or lowered and used as an orchestra pit or lowered even further to bring heavy items like pianos on stage. I have seen drawings of this amazing theater. It seems as modern as today, and though created in the late 1940s, its sophisticated design could have made the Playhouse one of the major showcases for semi-professional theater in the United States. Note, information in the preceding two paragraphs comes from a 1950 Playhouse brochure called Once in a Lifetime. By 1949, the Playhouse had simply outgrown its original space. Already, the Playhouse School of the Theater had been created to teach and train students from all over Allegheny County, and a children's theater was born, soon to be headed by Carnegie Tech graduate William K. Leach, who directed the first play, The Land of the Dragon, and who turned it into one of the most successful children's theaters in the United States. Even in 1998, it is still going strong, packing them in on weekends at the Point Park Playhouse. And in 1999, it celebrates its 50th anniversary, a lasting monument to Bill Leach. The Korean War had begun in June of 1950, and by July of 1951, because of steel shortages, the war stopped my father's ambitious project. In fact, while my parents and I were on vacation in Beach Haven, New Jersey, the board vetoed the Minute Car Wash location, citing the steel problem. It was a great setback for my father, who I suspect never quite believed the board's reasons for abandoning the project. The board had decided that an adjacent property, a 45-year-old synagogue, was available, and it was purchased in 1951. By May 1952, the new Craft Avenue Theater opened in a 550-seat theater. By 1984, that theater was renamed the Rockwell Theater with a seating capacity of 450. In 1954, two founders of the Playhouse, Mrs. J. Frank Drake, its first president, and my father, died. With them, a fabulous era had ended. I have often thought that the Playhouse's downfall began very subtly with its 1951 purchase of the synagogue. For one thing, the seating capacity in the Hamlet had gone from its original 260 seats to 337 by 1939. And now, in 1952, with the Kraft Theater, the total capacity was 887 seats. By 1959, the Playhouse added a third theater, the theater upstairs, intended for more adventurous alternative fare, and that added 67 additional seats. So the total was 954 seats to fill 8 months of the year, a task that became increasingly impossible in the 1960s. After 2 decades of growth, the Playhouse began to falter in the mid-1950s, and by the early 60s, it was evident that Burley's approach was not satisfying the Pittsburgh theater community. He was doing business as usual, and the Playhouse in general was facing lower attendance, skimpy corporate support, and rising deficits. In addition, television was making vigorous inroads into theater going. Now, A Night on the Town was an evening spent in front of a 19-inch TV set. So why did a theater born with such promise in 1934 collapse into bankruptcy in 1974? It seems that there was a whole array of factors. Instead of one culprit, there were many. Certainly high on the list was the endless battle between professional and non-professional theater. When Fred Burley took over in 1937, he repudiated Gallandre's equity-trained actor approach in favor of a Pittsburgh-oriented community theater, relying almost exclusively on local talent. Later, Burley modified this to include a few New York actors who were brought in for starring roles. He even induced one of London's best actresses, Flora Robeson, to appear at the Playhouse in 1942 in Suspect. and for the next 25 years, Burley's approach seemed to be satisfactory. But by 1964, board members, critics, and the public began to lobby for a new look for the Playhouse. And Burley, realizing that the board was no longer behind him, resigned in March 1965. William Ball, who founded the American Conservatory Theater at the Playhouse, was chosen in conjunction with Carnegie Tech to bring Pittsburgh a new professionalism. Pittsburgh Press writer and local actress Barbara Cloud wrote, quote, "Taking issue with the word can be dangerous, but I have a certain aversion to the word, quote, professional, unquote, which has been tossed about at length in the past week. Nobody wishes the Playhouse and Carnegie Tech more luck than I do in their repertory venture, but I don't like the implication that, quote, at last, unquote, we will have professionals in our midst," unquote. SJN, page 355. After complex negotiations and grants from the Rockefeller Foundation, the A.W. Mellon Educational and Charitable Foundation, the Sarah Mellon Scaife Foundation, and Carnegie Tech and the Playhouse, Ball came to Pittsburgh. The New York Times reported, quote, "William Ball, an alumnus of Carnegie's drama department, has been engaged as artistic director. Between July 14th and December 15th, Mr. Ball intends to put on 11 revivals with 30 professional actors to be supplemented by 20 students selected by Carnegie Tech," unquote. SJN, page 352. Ball announced a formidable season, including Tiny Alice, Tartuffe, Death of a Salesman, King Lear, Antigone, and Six Characters in Search of an Author. His acting company was equally impressive, including Cecily Tyson, Charles Durning, Richard Dysart, Rene Auberjonois, Yaphet Kotto, Carol Tytel, Paul Chenar, Lawrence Luckinbill, and Barbara Barry, to name only a few. Though the season was well received, Ball's tenure was often stormy. By December 1965, with the Playhouse facing a $300,000 deficit, not totally of his making, the board fired him. That event produced a large protest, especially from some dissident board members. From the moment of Ball's firing until 1968, the Playhouse was in constant turmoil. It was never sure whether it should be a professional, semi-professional, or community theater. Essentially, Ball's acting company was a throwback to Gallandre's 1930s company of imported New York actors, with an emphasis on a rigorous training program. The difference was in the large financial commitment needed to keep Ball afloat. But Ball created his own deficits, alienated some board members by his flamboyant behavior, and seemed aloof from Playhouse concerns. There were other problems, too. After Burley became artistic director in 1937, he brought from Indianapolis Richard Hoover, who became the general manager and a powerful force at the Playhouse until Hoover's resignation in 1967. It was Hoover who had supported Burley through Burley's 28 years, and it was Hoover, among others, who negotiated the ACT deal. The board clearly respected him, but it was Hoover who also helped to get rid of Burley, and it was Hoover who was influential in Ball's dismissal. Years later, Hoover was always considered the villain of the piece, yet it is still unclear about his influence, though it was formidable. Hoover made many enemies over the Ball's firing and Burley's resignation. "I know my mother didn't like Hoover, complaining often that he treated the Playhouse as if it were his own personal fiefdom." Another problem was money. During my father's tenure as president, he kept a tight lid on spending. Martin Pachapin, who served the Playhouse in extraordinary ways from the 1940s into the 1960s, and even in the 1990s sells program ads for the Point Park Company and the Dance Company, told me that my father would arrive every morning at 9 a.m. to check each expenditure. Deficits never arose until the 50s, and by the time ACT left, the Playhouse was seriously in the red. The board constantly battled Ball over money and the endless deficits. My mother, who was on the board at the time, told me that they felt Ball spending was chaotic. Hoover and the board also feared that if ACT continued, the Playhouse would lose its identity and disappear. In the board minutes, Hoover made these comments. Quote, "Abdication to the ACT would not necessarily be the worst thing that could happen, but it would very well mean the elimination of the school, the ballet, the restaurant, and other Playhouse-sponsored programs. If we are to adhere to our goal of excellence, two paths are open to us. One, the development of our own Playhouse resident company under new and first-rate leadership, and two, the continuance of ACT. If the latter course is taken, the entire organization would cease to exist. Unquote, SJN, page 367. 1 month later, Hoover said, quote, the partnership with ACT seems unworkable and unlivable, unquote. SJN, page 367. Years later, Hoover reflected on his feelings about Ball. Quote, Bill Ball was one of the most exciting people I ever worked with, but he got delusions of grandeur about himself and more particularly about money. He actually wanted $800,000 to finish the season. But what Ball wouldn't accept was that the money just wasn't available. Bill Ball tried to use us in order to build the ACT. It's true that his work was superior, but his ways were too often intolerable. Unquote. SJN, page 373. On a cold Sunday in December 1965, a telegram was pushed out of the front door of my mother's house. She was called to an emergency meeting of the board to discuss the Playhouse's $300,000 deficit, which threatened to close the Playhouse for good. The money was ultimately raised and the Playhouse saved, but this was just the beginning of an endless 8-year bailout. The Playhouse would go to the public and the foundations until everyone, including the corporations, told the Playhouse by 1973 that the well had run dry. After Ball's departure, the Playhouse picked another white knight to save them. John Hancock, director of the San Francisco Actors Workshop, was hired in 1966. He presented what he called his, quote, theater of excitement, unquote. It was exciting, but not the way he thought it would be. Richard Hoover's initial response was favorable. Quote, it is my opinion that Hancock, with all of his youth, his enthusiasm, and we believe his talent, will give us the kind of artistic leadership which I think we need. I find him extremely likable, reasonably pliable, artistically motivated, which I believe will lead to exciting theater. Unquote. SJN, page 384. But from the beginning, Hancock alienated Playhouse audiences, especially with his daring Brecht anti-war play, A Man's a Man, which featured an actor using a urinal on stage. That was a first for Playhouse audiences, who were turned off. And things didn't get better when in Hancock's A Midsummer Night's Dream, the audience discovered that Helena was played by a 6-foot-4-inch man, and there was even a real jukebox on stage. As the season went along, Hancock became increasingly hostile in newspaper interviews, and with the deficit once again escalating, the board fired him in June 1967. In a 1972 interview, Hoover reversed what he had said in 1966. Quote, Hancock was not my choice. I recommended Arthur Seidelman, who's doing well off-Broadway, but the moneyed board members wouldn't support it. I totally disagreed with his approach to theater. I resigned after his second production, Streetcar. I believed it was tasteless trash, but my resignation was refused. Unquote. SJN, page 405. Dissident board members, still seething from the Ball controversy, resigned after Hancock's departure. It could be surmised that the Future City Theater and Pittsburgh Public Theater were born in the frustration, anger, and disappointment of losing Ball and Hancock and the professionalism they represented. For the 1967-68 season, KDKA television executive Robert Novak and Ron Satloff, a Carnegie Tech graduate, were brought in to solve the Playhouse's problems and gain back lost community support. They wanted to regain lost subscribers who numbered 8,000 before Hancock and now were 5,500 when Satloff arrived. SJN, page 417. After the storm and drang of the past two seasons, artistic director Satloff proposed a season of plays to please everybody. Henry IV, Albee's A Delicate Balance, Miller's After the Fall, Shaw's Arms and the Man, Simon's The Odd Couple, Mary Rogers' Once Upon a Mattress, one of my mother's last plays, and George M. Cohan's The Tavern. Satloff employed even more local actors, but still imported many from New York and Chicago. Even Harvey Keitel appeared in 1968, and the subject was Roses, and Alan Alda's father, Robert, starred in the biggest grosser of the year, The Odd Couple. SJN, page 427 to 428. Despite Novak's and Satloff's best efforts to revive the Playhouse, the deficits inherited from past seasons were insurmountable, and in early 1968, the Playhouse again faced oblivion. This time, many buyers emerged to save the theater, including the University of Pittsburgh, Point Park College, Kenny Ross Chevrolet, who wanted to put a Chevrolet dealership on the property, and the Theater of the Living Arts in Philadelphia, SJN, page 431 to 432. Only Point Park College, after first backing out of the deal, agreed to purchase the Playhouse building and its debts. Part of the final Playhouse deal came from Mark Lewis, who had first come there in 1953 after Carnegie Tech and Stanford. By 1956, he became head of the Playhouse School, running it successfully for many years, and by 1968, he became general manager. Lewis proposed that the Playhouse and Point Park boards merge and then outline in a proposal the mutual advantages of this connection between a theater and a college. It was the Playhouse's last hope. By the fall, Lewis was given a one-year term as general manager and created a season that was a little bit of everything, with an emphasis on local actors and directors. The season began with The Odd Couple,